And I was on Twitter and everyone was like, Capital's like, what is happening?
Keep up to date with the latest WSL action and the biggest interviews.
It's just a measure of how their season has been going. They can't catch a break no matter how hard they're trying.
Subscribe to the Koi Gig podcast stream on the OTV Sports app now.
Off the ball.
Find us on Twitter at Off the Ball.
News Talk 106 to 108.
Now, you're welcome along. So happy to bring in Aidan O'Mahony, five times an All-Ireland winner with Kerry, 10 Munster titles, and he's written a new biography, Unbroken. He joins us on the line now. Aidan, great to have you on.
Hi, Joe. How are you?
Yeah, very well. So the motivation behind the book, because you were never a player, I think, who sought publicity in any great way or opened up in any great way publicly. So why do it now? What was the thinking?
Yeah, I think you got it right. I think I'm probably the worst person, I'd say, in the media. Journalists told you I was probably the worst person ever to interview. Yeah, look, in 2019, I went on the Camino with Pride, Cardiff, Risking Young People. It's a charity based in Dublin. And when you're on the Camino like that, you have plenty of time to reflect. And for me, I came away from it with kind of two goals. I had two young kids, so I wanted to learn how to swim. And the second one was the thought of a book. And lo and behold, Ciara Dooley from Hachette contacted me in March the following year, early 2020, about writing a book.
When you're on the walk, what parts of your life do you find yourself reflecting on the most?
Like, I think the biggest thing, Joe, was the very first night we were there. There was 22 people there, and we were sitting around a big timber table, and every person stood up and gave the reason why they were there, and you know, it's something, it's a memory that will stay with me for the rest of my life. You know, parents having lost young kids, me going over there, having a two-year-old and feeling how lucky and blessed I was. And these are these people opening themselves up and, you know, sharing everything that what they'd lost and that outpouring of emotion between 22 strangers on the very first night around the table. And obviously there was some positive stories as well where we had a guy that had open heart surgery and he was there with his six friends. So that journey every day was you're walking with people that you've never met in your life, and it's like being so open with someone along that journey that you don't even know. And I kind of found when I was coming home then that I was a person that probably hid behind a jersey and people didn't know who I was, and I felt like even getting on the plane that day, it's like being a bit of a fraud that you talk about having a career in a Kerry jersey, but nobody knows the person. And, you know, if I was going writing the book, then it had to be an open and honest one.
And what did you say on that first night in the Camino when it was your turn to speak?
I told him the reason I was there. I'd lost my own dad to a heart attack in 2012. You know, I didn't go into the whole, I suppose, side of mental health or being an Asheri in 2010. I don't think it was the time and the place for it, because for the group I was with, for them, it was a journey they were going on, I suppose, to heal them. My own journey was, I suppose, one in kind of quietness that I was going on myself, that I'd been there, no one knew about. And, you know, there's one way to kind of open up to people, and you put something in a book and there's no going back from it.
To jump back right to the start, it was kind of striking, you were saying, of your upbringing in Mount Horgan, Rathmore, grew up in a farm and very isolated, and even in your primary school class, just four kids in your primary school class growing up, and you made an observation, I mean, to what extent it's true, who knows, but you certainly remarked that, you know, in terms of personality development or social skills, they would have maybe suffered as opposed to a child maybe living, I don't know, in somewhere urban with kids all around and a big primary school class all around them.
Yeah, it was very simple, you know. It's like the old cliche, we either walk to school, our principal, our vice principal would pass us every morning, we'd hide behind the walls so that she wouldn't pick us up, so we'd be late for school. But, you know, we grew up in a very small school. Tom Sullivan, the ex-Kerry player, he went to that school as well. And, you know, it was a very simple life. He went home after, you know, I went home after school, and we had a cow that we milked at home for milk, and everything was kind of grown off the land. And my brother Noel would come down and collect me, and we'd go to our farm and play, Joe. And there was nothing outside of it. Like, for me, football was the last thing on my mind. I had no aspirations or kind of kind of an outlook of being a Kerry footballer. You know, I wanted to be a farmer, and my brother was saying it. And that's the way we grew up, you know, like, as you said, small communities. You cycled to your football training. It wasn't the be-all and end-all. You got maybe 10 or 15 minutes of a game. And then it was back home because my parents were big into education as well. And there was seven kids, and I was the youngest of seven. Like, so, you know, you kind of, you worked on the farm, and you worked hard. Like, you went to the bog in the summer, and you cut hay in the summer. And, like, you spend most of the time out the hill where we have in Gilflesk, where you have a couple of hundred sheep and you're trying to round them up, and that was your week.
Do you reflect on it fondly?
Absolutely, Joe, yeah. I think part of me from maybe 2004 to 2010 lost that person, where it was a very simple way of life, you know, where you go back, and I always say our farm is up in the mountains. It's very therapeutic. You go up to the top of the mountain and you're looking over the Killarney Lakes. You know, you go to the different seasons, like where you have your sheep lambing, to put him out the hills. Everything was tough, where you drew bales or poles or nuts. Everything had to be. There was no tractors or anything could drive up the fields. But it was what we were used to. We knew no different. And I loved that way of life. And, you know, I suppose it made me, I suppose, some of the athlete I was in the last couple of years.
You definitely paint a good picture of how tough training is at senior level when you get in there. That all the, I mean, because, you know, we're kind of going chronologically in a sense, as the book does, and it's a fight, you know, at minor level, and there's a real step up at 21s, and then you have to do more than just being happy to be there. And then you do that and you think, God, you're really rolling now. And then, you know, like senior is like that whole moment where you're trying to climb a mountain and you get to what you think is the peak and you see that the real business is about to start. Which is, looking at you now and across your career, because I always just thought you were such a fitness freak. I was kind of surprised. I had you down as a natural athlete who would have always found that aspect of the game very easy.
Absolutely not. No, like the asthma was a big hurdle. I'm not going to go into too much because you talk about Kerry football, like, and being as a young player. And when I went in there the very first night, we were in the small pitch in Fitzgerald Stadium, and I wanted to lay down a marker. I wanted to show how fit I was. I was asked to come in from CIT playing Sigerson. And the first eight laps, John O'Keefe was training us, so we're up the hill and come down the other side. And I was flexing that, and I said, right, eight. But sure, I didn't realise there was eight more. And they could see some of the senior lads were giggling away. And for the second eight, every lap, I was going back and back. And then in the finish, I came off. I'm at one stage, and my mindset was gone. I'd given in, thrown in the towel. Then I came down and said to Paddy, I said, my master pulling my hamstring. And he said, fine. And I walked in off the field. It's like nearly a dead store because I wasn't not even ready for it. I didn't even know it was ahead of me. And that was a Tuesday night. And then the Thursday night, I came back in, bag on my shoulder, ready for work again, and walked in the past party. And he said, how's the hamstring? And I said, yeah, it's good, yeah, yeah. He said, I don't think it was a hamstring. He said, I think you blew the head gasket. And he was right.
He'd seen it all before, I think.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. And like those first nights inside, I remember even marking the likes of these guys, you know, I'd be kind of pulling drag out of them. And, you know, you got back a bucket load and spades from whoever you were marking. And it was kind of an eye-opener to me that at that time of the year, every player wasn't playing for a team. They were playing for their jersey number one. You know, it was all about them. And there wasn't some upstart like myself going to come in and take a jersey off them too easy.
If you look at your career on paper, 04, you come in your first big year, All-Ireland winner. 05 is the Tyrone defeat and that great Tyrone team of 03 and 05 and 08. And those matches were iconic in some ways, those Kerry-Tyrone matches. But 04, All-Ireland winner. 06, All-Ireland winner again after that Tyrone defeat the year before. Man of the match, few points in the final. Marked Kieran McDonald. And 07, All-Ireland winner again. All-star. So on the outside, that looks like you're incredibly comfortable and this is all coming very easily. But it was very striking again, reading the book. You know, plenty of doubt. Am I going to keep my place? Where do I fit in at this level? And, you know, you're going to be marking Stephen O'Neill in the All-Ireland final against Tyrone, and lots of doubts as well. So on the outside, it kind of looked like you took to this seamlessly, whereas there was a lot of kicking under the water. Now, you kind of got away with it, but a lot of kicking under the water.
Absolutely, yeah. Like, and you said it there, I think a lot of it's where you come from. A lot of it was myself. It was that kind of a person I was. I was a total introvert, and I have no problem saying it. you know, my personality, as you said there about media and stuff, trying to interview me, was like, I'd say, trying to get blood out of the turnip. And, you know, because you're always afraid you'd say the wrong thing. And it was different with football as well, where I had in my mindset going to Ireland finals, where you don't want to be the person to let down the team. And it was only when I was writing the book, you were looking back, and you spoke about 2005 and getting that, you know, that honour to Mark Stephen O'Neill. Like, that was the, I suppose, Jack giving me that opportunity, or putting that kind of fortune in me to say, look, we trust you so much, we'll put you on Stephen O'Neill. And it was only when I was writing the book I saw those things. But when you're playing, it was always my mindset that I didn't want to be someone to let down the team, or, you know, be the cause of losing all our final. And that's fine. Like, it's from, that was my mindset. And it actually suited me, because going into games, like, I always have butterflies, and I always say they're a good thing. But, like, all our final day, and when you're coming home to Kerry, when you lose, you know, you're judged when you're Ireland. So I knew that from an early age. But I think those things kind of stood to me, that fear, and that probably side of where I didn't back myself as much, maybe kind of kept me on my toes more than anything.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure it makes it a slightly unpleasant build-up, but there is an upside to that fear. It keeps you so sharp, and maybe if you didn't have that fear, you're not the same player. Especially, I think, for a defender. You know, I think a defender needs that bit of fear to be on their toes. Maybe an attacker can tighten up a touch, and you need to be a bit more relaxed to play your best stuff. But, like, I can imagine going out fearful of Stephen O'Neill, and therefore so attuned to his every movement. That doesn't hurt you in the 70 minutes, whatever about the fun and games in advance.
No, I mean, you know, if you ever hear sports psychology, you know, and they talk about, you know, it's not about the first ball, it's always about the next ball and the next ball. I remember the first ball that came in, I think I caught it over his head, and by God, it gave me a massive boost of confidence, and then I started coming more into the game. And obviously in the second half, then I was doing so well, and I remember being up under the Cusick stand side, and he had the ball on his left leg, and I was saying, right, he's going to kick it in the air, and he's about 40 yards out on the sideline and bangs it over the bar. I'm saying, Jesus Christ. And then a few minutes later, he goes to the other side of the pitch and kicks from his other side. And I'm saying, oh my God, oh my bush. I think there are learning curves. I think when you're young like that, and like as you said, you're thrown in 2004, my first I learned fine. Like, I shipped a goal straight away. And you're nearly looking at the sideline saying, I'm going to be whipped off here. And obviously, management has a bit of faith in you and they leave you on. But like, it's like a learning curve. And I think a lot of the stuff in the book is, you know, where you talk about games where, I'm just being honest about it really, in that, you know, I felt the effects going into every game, but I think it stood to me. And yes, I did enjoy them. I absolutely enjoyed them. And I loved the battles, and the older I got, I think the more wiser I got and the bigger the day was, the more I enjoyed it. But in those early years, it's like a building block for any young player, where, like, you're surrounded by greatness. You have the likes of Seamus Byrne, Dara Shea, the Gooches, Declan O'Sullivan, and as you said there, I wasn't a superstar by any means. I wasn't back then either. So, like, you're just like a cog in the wheel where you're plugging a hole, but you need to do your end of the job for the rest to succeed.
You loved Jack O'Connor. I mean, if we're going through some of the managers, you loved how he'd simplify a message for you. And it seemed, especially in those early years, although not exclusively because 2014 and the job and Michael Murphy, but certainly there was a man-marking quality to your performance. And Jack O'Connor would give you confidence, and the message would be as simple as, look, if we don't see your man, I don't need to see you. That's all you have to do.
Yeah, it's either that or he knew my skill set. I think, yeah, he made it very simple.
Were you happy in that role? You didn't have this inner longing to be the Jack McCaffrey roaming up the pitch?
No, I think I went up a few times, Joe, and like my success rate at kicking points was good enough, because I knew my limit as well. Anytime I'd kick a point, I'd look to the sideline and I'd see Jack, and there was no smile. I think there was more reaction he's faced, and you shouldn't be up there. But no, I enjoyed it because, as you said, it kept it very simple for someone coming in like that. Mark your man, keep him out of the game, stay out of the game yourself. You're doing something for the team. You know, we had Tomás O'Shea in that team. We didn't need to stay in the mat and he got the pitch, because Tomás had enough, and when Tomás went up, you know, he was always successful, or his conversion rate was always good. So he did simplify. And look, like, I know, from saying myself and Jack had plenty of runs of training down through the years. I think I got a phone call 1 year from some of Mark here or something saying, did we come to blows inside in training, that someone was looking over the wall and the ladder, and I was kind of laughing, saying, yeah, sure, look, I suppose we have two very strong personalities when it comes to sport. you know, Jack is set in his ways and I'm set in the way I play as well. And when you put those two head to head, you know, you're going to get a bit of conflict, but the respect there is massive. And, you know, I can see from now, being a manager myself, that it's a very tough job and you're dealing with 20 different personalities. And we had big personalities back then, but I think he enjoyed it. I think he enjoyed it that we kept him on his toes.
Mm. So things are going really well. And then you hit a crisis point in your football, but maybe more to the point, your life as well. Two things really start to accelerate a decline of sorts. The Dunica O'Connor affair and the 08 positive test. The Dunica O'Connor affair, it was clearly this seismic thing in your world. Honestly, I couldn't remember it. It was just so, like, you know, instantly forgot. Maybe in Cork and probably in Kerry not. I think the other 30 counties had got over this fairly bloody quickly. But it was amazing to read, you know. So you and Dunica O'Connor on the sideline, Croke Park. He gives a little slap of the hand, I don't know, to your chin or to your cheek. And you go down like you've been shot. And look, you know, no one's saying your world's greatest moment. But at the same time, I'd say most people kind of after their match were had fairly forgotten about it. You get text message afterwards, RTÉ are going to town on you. This is becoming a big story. You're at this stage, you're a guard in Cork City. You see the local paper has, you know, the front page is just cheat. And it's you there. And I think your first visitor to the Garda station to get their passport stamped that week tells you you should be ashamed of yourself. So, like, I get the immediate 48-hour, 72-hour furore. It's amazing the extent to which this probably, you say in the book, took you 2 years to fully get over and get past. So explain that to us, because like I said, I think for most people, this was only a touch above routine cut and thrust of what happens in the world. Why did it linger around you so long, do you feel?
Yeah, look, I suppose a few things. Look, number one, you know, like football is a religion in Kerry, and that wasn't looked on too kindly. For me, my mindset, as I said at the time, was that whatever good that I'd done in football was undone for that. That would be something I'd be remembered by. You know, it was no needed nothing to do with it was totally my fault. And like, as a player and from myself, like, I played in the line, and you know, like, you go on the pitch and you cross the white line and you bring a part of you for the team, as in you're thick and tough. Like, all of a sudden you throw yourself on the turf and Croke Park and the local derby between Kerry and Cork. It doesn't go too easily, Joe. Like, I think it ate away at me for a long time, because it was myself. Like, I was my own worst enemy, because I judged myself with such high standards. And how could you bring yourself back up to high standards when you do something like that in the pitch? And I genuinely mean that. And that was my mindset, and even writing the book. Like, I look back on that and I was embarrassed, my family having to see that, and, you know, everything that goes with it as well, and your guard and all these things, and every night you're on duty above in Cork, you know, it's been thrown back to you, and rightly so. And that was my mindset at the time. I deserved everything I was getting, and there's just no part in GA for it. And like, I just kept telling myself, like, why do you do it and all this. And
but did like, because even I can even hear now a touch of embarrassment. Like, did no part of your brain or people around you go, look, let's be honest, you did it because you wanted to win and we're out there. Like, nobody got shot. No, it wasn't a crime. You're a guard. You're seeing terrible things happening all the time. Yeah, it wasn't great. Not your greatest moment. But at the same time, we got to put some perspective here, you know. I mean, words like embarrassment and what it meant to your family, you know, it's really severe language, isn't it?
It is. And like, it's being honest. You know, as I said, it was getting letters in the door. And that's fine. You know, I've no problem people sending me messages and stuff. And even nowadays when I do our Instagram page, Area One Fitness, you know, people send me in a question. They'd be like, you're a cheat and you're this and that. And they'll send me on the video that or tag me in it constantly. And it's the same people the whole time, obviously. Yeah. But, you know, I can answer no and I can deal with no. But back then, it was like a touching point that I couldn't deal with, where I just said, like, that's what I'd be remembered for. And like, as I said, like, when you're an introvert, Joe, and I genuinely mean this, it's very hard to deal with some of that, because after an incident like that, you know, you definitely need to talk to someone. And even before it, I had plenty of issues through my life, and it wasn't even the Dunica O'Connor thing that led on to 2010. It was irrelevant. It was nothing to do with that. But those are the small points. Like, I just couldn't deal with them, where I went away and said, yeah, I'm bulletproof here. I'm fine. You know, and Grant laughed him off, but it ate me away because, as I said, you were two things where you get an opportunity in the Kerry jersey and you play on the line. And I'm not going to say I was a tough man or anything, but I enjoyed that part of it. I enjoyed the contact part of it. And then for that to happen, it just, I don't know, it was, you know, looking back now, yeah, I can say fine. There's probably several reasons for it. But for those 2 years, it was embarrassed, I think is an easy word to say about it, but doesn't happen in GAA, and why did it myself? I'm just kind of, I don't know, I think it took away a lot of the glass from my career as well.
Yeah. Which is such a pity. I mean, I'd forgotten about it until I read the book again. It's just, it would not be something that I would associate with you at all. And we've seen it since. I mean, and we see players going down easily all the time, and it's a part of life a little bit, you know, and in those 2-3 seconds, I think everyone understands you don't have time to go off and have a think for half an hour. What'll I do here? What's the best thing to do? Like, you react in the moment. I mean, a little slap was thrown towards your face. So, like, I get it. I think most people would get it as well. Was the Kerry dressing room angry about it, or did they feel they'd been let down on some kind of philosophical level, or would they have known you were struggling?
I suppose the biggest saving grace was that there was a replay the following week. Yeah. I think the one I got off lightly with Derrick, which actually is in Dolphin's game, and it kind of covered it. But no, look, I think writing the book and you're talking about the memory of these things, like, I had that passage from start to finish, and then after, like, Pache had to go in, like, and it's tough enough having to get set for a replay where you're dealing with this kind of thing, and then I'm coming out to apologise. And, you know, I think the biggest thing was I found in my career, and what led to probably 2010, was listening to outside voices, and people are very quick to put you down when you do something wrong. It's probably when you do something very good that they wouldn't even pick up a phone to. And look, I suppose it was my own fault that I left all those external voices in, but for me at the time, it was just something that shouldn't have happened. It did, and I think probably writing it was probably therapeutic as well, because I know a lot of people that have read the book have messaged me and saying, geez, we thought you wouldn't address that, but why wouldn't I, you know? And it's not for me to kind of say, oh, this is my side of the story. It was just being honest and saying, I did it. You know, I apologise for it. I owned it. I wish it didn't happen, but it did. And you move on in life. But for me, I think that was one of the things, along with several other things before it, that led on to 2010.
Yeah. So this is going on in the background, and then there's the positive test after the 08 final, 17th of November 2008 GAA statement, and they were saying a player tested positive for salbutamol, and pretty quickly your name leaks out into the media. And this is, I mean, I can understand the absolute horror and panic over this, even more so than the Dunnock O'Connor situation. This gets very serious very quickly. You have to get a solicitor. You're looking at a ban for potentially 2 years, and you have to go before a committee. So I presume, I mean, well, I know from reading the book, but your asthma had been there from childhood. Inhalers around training sessions, and even I think daily as well, but certainly training sessions and matches, it would have been very, very rare across the previous 20 years of your life to have been without your inhaler and to not have taken your inhaler. Is that right?
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah.
So, like, I was diagnosed with asthma when I was 8. I think the first thing, Joe, was that morning, I finished duty at 6 o'clock in the morning, and, like, I wrote this in the book where I had 89 missed calls. I actually had 89 missed calls. I think I had one of those old Nokia phones where it was like a block. And you see the 89 next, you click into them, and then there's messages to follow every one of them saying, you need to talk to this, you need to talk to that. And then the message that stood out to me was, like, your name is going to be leaked as failing a drug test. And lo and behold, it was above in Dublin. And that day I was going to see Munster and the All Blacks, which two of my friends, Ollie and Michael Anthony, and I knew getting into the car, it was a bad idea, but look, you know, the phone was just hopping and I didn't get back to anyone. And then we went to Clem Smith's bar in Limerick before we went to the game, and then in the sixth one, it was a poke, Kerry GAA footballer Aidan O'Mahony. And, like, as I said, if I ever wanted to ground, just swallowed up in my life, it was then standing in the middle of the bar, and next you could hear the whispers, he's there, he's there, he's an angel there. And, you know, like, for a negative story like that, people are quick enough to jump on it. And it's very hard to, I suppose, explain yourself to someone that's after alcohol or someone that's in a public house, and they just start jumping to conclusions straight away because there was no mention of an inhaler, and it just snowballed from there. You know, I met Packy Durham, and like I explained myself to him, the biggest thing I think that came out of the whole thing was that I put down that I use inhaler, we'll say three times a day, and that I hadn't put down two puffs each time. That was simply put, it was never addressed in the media, and it just went on because I know it's a quiet time of the year. And then there was talk about GPA grants, and the other man, he gets a GPA grant even though he failed the drugs test. And then that started on, and there was a two-year ban hanging over, and there was a final meeting in December, and it pushed on until January 22nd. And at that stage, I probably was saying to myself, I wish I had never put on the jersey, because, like, outside of me, you can imagine my parents, maybe out in the countryside, going doing their shopping on a Monday morning or going to mass on a Saturday night, and everyone talking about their son failing a drug test.
Mm. The committee established or accepted that you hadn't been trying to enhance your performance and you had taken the salbutamol while using your inhaler. I think you were maybe twice the level. And you say in the book that potentially night of an All-Ireland final, wake up during the night, take a puff in the morning, and then during the game as well, and that's suddenly how you get to however many puffs ultimately you take them, which was over the limit. Because the cynic could say, well, is there a degree here of like, oh, sure, I'll take an extra few puffs and open out the lungs and it'll give me a bit of a boost. You know, that would be the uncharitable, I'm sure, but also a rather cynical interpretation, you know. Had you been taking similar numbers of puffs for previous games?
Like, I always took my inhaler, Joe, when I needed it, you know, and I was tested several times. The biggest thing I'd say was, it was the worst game I ever played, in a Kerry jersey. So, you know, like I can laugh about it now, but back then, like, it was very serious. And, like, I know, like, I'm training teams now, and people are asthmatic. They come in, they take their inhaler when they need it. Like, what I said above in the meeting that night is that, like, what if someone has an asthma attack on the pitch, or what if someone needs their inhaler? You say, sorry, you can't take it because you put yourself over the level. Or is that the level you're going to? And for me, like, that time, even filling out the therapeutic exemption forms, you were there in January, you filled out the form. What were you doing? You wanted to get back in the train straight away because it was a year ahead of you. You didn't even think about it. You know, it was, I don't think the whole thing about drug testing really took off until after that case. I don't think teams took it as serious until after that case finalized. And I think, so, you know, it was, and to be, named the first person ever to fail a drug test, and you're asthmatic, and it's salbutamol. As I said, one of the papers, like, where your front page and heads into the workplace, and next you're going upstairs to your boss, your superintendent, your chief superintendent, and you're writing an email trying to explain yourself. Like, it's something that play around your mind fairly quickly. And for me, then getting to 2009, like, GA was probably the last place I wanted to be.
Yeah, I can imagine. I mean, look, just to have, you know, drug cheat associated with anyone's name is horrific. You know, there's a public shaming aspect to it. Because Jerome Conway, the Kerry chairman, said that you'd had flu symptoms that weekend. Was that right? That wasn't mentioned in the book.
Yeah, and like, look, sure, if I put that in the book, Joe, they'd be saying, oh, he's only making excuses. That's the last thing I want to be doing.
Right.
I think coming into North Ireland, look, you knew it like that. Even the night before a game, like, the anxiety and everything going into it, and I'm not going to make excuses. It is what it is. And that's just the way it all petered out, and quite nothing to hide. But, like, someone said, why didn't you come out in the very start? How do you come out at the very start? And try to explain yourself after your name is being leaked and you're saying you're at a failure drug test. What do you exactly say?
Yeah, to be fair to you, you do say in the book, it's my fault I didn't know what the threshold is. I hold my hands up on that.
Absolutely, yeah. And, like, not being smart, but who comes in the start of the year and says, right, you can take four puffs, or you can take six puffs, or you can take two puffs.
Yeah. I'd say it's happening now, actually. I would think. I don't know, but I would say it is happening now.
Possibly, yeah. Yeah. But, like as I said in the book, like, well, what happens in November then when you're going training and it's fast and next you can't breathe and you're trying to get through training?
Sure.
Just say, oh, I took a puff on the hair, I can't take it again.
I mean, I suspect they are doing that now, probably because they've seen what happened to you. I suspect they are saying, I've hit my limit, or I need to go back to the TUE and ask for dispensation.
There's way more advice than now as well, you know, compared to what there was back then. But it was just something that snowballed into something that wasn't controllable from my side, you know.
Yeah. So we have you here as somebody with incredibly high standards, introverted. By the way, we keep saying introverted like it's a bad word. I mean, lots of the great people in the world are introverted, but I understand what you mean by it. Introverted and generally keeping away from the limelight. And so, bang, Dunica O'Connor, very public, and, you know, the fallout continues, especially in your day-to-day life around Cork and Kerry. And then, you know, national attention, 6-1 News kind of stuff for this, and it drags on for several months. So, yeah, by 09, you get dropped in 09, and Kerry winning All-Ireland. It's the year Paul Galvin's brilliant man on a mission. And so I guess on the outside, it would look like, you know, maybe you're getting back to yourself. Certainly the league in 2010, you're going well in the league. And people would have definitely said, OK, look, he's had a rocky time, but he's getting back to his best now. And then suddenly, as Jack O'Connor and the team are thinking of heading off for warm weather training after the league, he gets a text from you to say, I'm not going to make it. And you yourself even say it's like, it's a little out of character, it's a little disrespectful, like, I'm turning off my phone, I just text you, no more explanation. So at that stage, you're done with football. You had reached crisis point.
Yeah, and I think, like as you said, 2009, I think the only two positive summers were, for me, that Darren O'Sullivan, some guy I'd be very close with, lifted Sam Guerin, and obviously Paul, who I played with for my whole year, he got his player of the year. But for me, and let's be honest, I didn't enjoy the year. It was the first time I was dropped. I was in fierce negative mindset. Like when I was righteous, looking back at the person, I hated that person. And I won't say it too easy, Joe, but I actually did. I can remember coming into 2010, and as you were saying there, I'd be reading forums and people saying, yeah, the man, he's coming to form, now he's back to himself. I was far from it. I can remember going out after games, something that I wouldn't have been doing before. The final league game against Tyrone, I got sent off. I think we played the club game the following week, I got sent off from that. Going out after the game, and I was just drained. As I said, my mind was nowhere near football. I found myself going into work where it was just like routine, which shouldn't be in life. I can remember getting into the car at training and halfway through, I'd be crying. And like back then, for me, like mental health wasn't spoken about. You know, I didn't know what was wrong with me. I had this persona, what people thought of me when I put on that jersey, you know, kicked off. And I found that, you know, that I could keep the whole lot in. And if I did something about it, then it would be seen as a weakness. And it just got too much where the Monday after the club game, I can remember being out and I just had enough at that stage. It was like writing that message. It was like writing your career away. It was a hard one to do when you revisit it, writing the book. I can remember every step, and I sent it to someone that I knew that it would travel. And it was like a relief in one sense. And, you know, I loved those training camps. I knew that G had given me an identity. But I was willing to walk away from it, and I was willing to give up everything. You know, I know that time in my life where there was like two roads, where one was going into a very dark place, and the second one was where I'm very lucky that I have a very supportive family, but, you know, I'm able to choose that Wednesday morning, waking up and pulling myself out of bed and sitting down at the breakfast table, and no words spoken, and my mom and dad were there, and they're in their 60s, and my dad was crying, and he was a generation that didn't cry, like, so he was a tough place to be in, and so, you know,
Your sister Nora was coming to pick you up to go to Ashiri. I'm probably mispronouncing that, but they treat addictions, but not exclusively so. And it was for a 6-week stay to try and get some help. You know, you talked about the negativity, say 09 into 10, and you say in the book, you know, I'd even go out for a few drinks with the lads, and it wasn't fun because my mind was so negative. or you said, you know, a few drinks and you could get emotional because the mm-hmm. emotion which you were, I suppose, repressing in a sense would come out. And you said your mind was overactive, rumination, constant thinking. Was it the Dunnock O'Connor stuff? Was it the pressures of Kerry? Was it the positive test? Was it stuff away from football entirely, just your private life and negative thought on the future? What do you remember in that period was particularly, would pop into your head on those horrible periods of downward spiral in your thinking?
Yeah, like I think a lot of it was, I think, I'd say my own life more than anything. And then when we say throughout an age, you add on those little things because you can just name one thing, Joe, and say, yeah, that happened there and yeah. hope and that's why I led me to that. It's not like I found in 2010 I was going out more after games, you know, something that I wouldn't do because I saw myself as an athlete. And then why all of a sudden am I doing this? And then like the emotions coming up after being out nights and, you know, not being able to think. And like I knew my family could see straight off where this is a guy that's gone through his career 20 years or gone through his life 20 years, never spoke about anything. I was a deep character. You know, I have no problem saying it. And like that morning, and even writing, it was very tough where, as I said, your mom and dad are crying. And you're kind of saying to yourself, and I see myself now being a dad of two girls where, you know, I suppose for them, like, it's like they feel like a failure because their 30-year-old son is at the breakfast table in the morning, like, and he's nearly walking away from life, in which just everything came on top of it. And as I said, like, the whole introvert thing is not the way you grow up, but it's the way you bring yourself up. And that was me. You know, I never dealt with anything in my life because I would have seen it as a weakness. I never spoke to anyone about my own health or my mental health because I would have seen it as a weakness. And that car journey, going up to Ashery, it wasn't a tough one because I spent the whole time looking out the windows at the grey clouds. It was a very kind of fitting kind of scenery for it. And walking in that gate, like, you were kind of saying to yourself, geez, what do people think of me? But a lot of it before I went in there was, I had this kind of mindset, like, I'd read the forums and all the negativity about me. If there was two things negative and eight things positive, I'd take two things negative on board. And that was the mindset I was in. And it was just a dangerous mindset where I genuinely don't know, Joe, where that role would have gone. And I can honestly say hand in heart about that. And that's why I needed to put that in the book.
Your 6 weeks there seem to be transformative.
Yeah, it was 6 weeks where you're kind of the unknown. You don't know what's ahead of you. You're going in and you're the same person maybe after a few days because you're not dropping your barrier. And then you do. And you start addressing things. You start dealing with things. You get time to think. There's no mobile phones. There's no contact with the outside world. I think I had contact with maybe two people. One of them is an ex-Kerry footballer as well, some guy that I didn't believe in time for. And another guy was a trainer at the time. And, you know, you're inside there. And for me, you know, there's no trainer in that. But obviously, I kind of skipped that side and I found a hill to run up and down nearly two or three times a day. And I do my steps in the morning and night time. And I found that exercise was starting to benefit me. But at the same time, I was actually finding the young person that I grew up as, things were very simple. And, you know, you're inside there with 10 or 11 people and they're being open and honest as well. Like, and, you know, the last day of the ceremony, you burn all your thoughts and stuff. And then you come out, like, it's like having been away. Like, you look at COVID now and people being isolated and stuff like that. I did 6 weeks where I found it very beneficial, where I could put my head in the pillow at night time at 10 o'clock and go to sleep. And not have it rambling or ruminating, as we said. Yes.
And Aidan, could I ask, if it's too personal, we move on. Aside from the GA stuff, you said, you know, it's stuff in my life. What thought or thoughts from your life had been hurting you or dominating your thinking?
Look, there had been a few incidents in my life. In 2004, I suppose, there was a highly publicised case as well involving my current job, which isn't in the book, but, you know, things like that you don't deal with down through life. And, you know, it was for me to address those things then and to talk about them and why they were happening. And
talking about them?
Yeah, talking about them, yeah, because, like, I never did, Joe, because I kept everything to myself because I thought I was that person that, you know, like, when you grew up probably in a farming background and then you come into county scene as one of these teak tough players that plays on the edge, and all of a sudden you can be kind of showing weakness, and that was my mindset. And compared to the person I know, and it's funny, like, and I spoke to someone last week and they said to me, ah, sure, I met a few people there and they said, Joe, I'm looking for publicity. And I said, do you think if I was looking for publicity, I'd lay everything bare inside the book that my young kids would read in 10 or 15 years? Obviously not. I'm just showing the person that I was.
And are you better now if you're having a day on your own and stuff's bothering you and you come in and your wife Denise, now you met after all this, says you don't seem in great form, how are you? Are you better now at not saying I'm fine, I'm grand?
Yeah, she actually always knew when I played good or bad in football. She'd come home with that mindset, which was, I was told after I retired, she knew if I was starting or she knew if I had a bad game. You're never perfect.
Sure.
I'm not someone that went in there next all of a sudden coming out and starting everyone else's problems. You don't do that. I try to look after myself. Obviously, I'm good and bad there still. You know, that's the person I am. But I'm more open, and I feel that even after writing this book, that I can be more open with people. Like the amount of messages I've got from ex and the county players, the lads I played against that have been in similar situations. So, and it's just nice to be able to have that conversation with them then, where before, you know, I was, as you said, like the media-wise, I was like a stone trying to talk to, and probably the worst person that you could interview. And no, actually, I'm like I'm talking to you now.
Mm.
Just being open and honest about it, I'm not tied.
We don't have time to touch on, I mean, it's terribly sad, the passing of your father, and then you almost privately saying I'm going to win an All-Ireland for him, and ironically the last player you'd been chatting about on the phone with him was Michael Murphy, and you do this extraordinary man-marking job and Michael Murphy in the 14 final, and that's a kind of culmination of a tough couple of years. And I mean, more recently, just to wrap things up, we've seen you on Dancing with the Stars, which you probably say yourself is not something you might have thrown yourself into if you hadn't almost hit the crisis point and thought about yourself as a person and been more open to things, I suppose. And then even the fitness company is something that you've thrown yourself into the last couple of years, and that seems to be, you know, really positive outlet for you, and seems to be going very well as well.
Yeah, and like the dancing thing, I probably needed more stress in my life, so I took it on. But no, and seriously, it was probably something that I would have said day one when I got the phone call that, you know, that's not me, or I'd be outside my comfort zone. And when all those negatives added up, I said, look, why not go for it? And it was an amazing experience, and it was tough as well. And the fitness thing is, it's part of who I am, Joe. Like, it's when I was retiring in 2017, 2016, I went to Santa College and started studying. And, you know, that's part of who I am. I've realized from my years of playing with Kerry and from going into Ashery that exercise and fitness is part of who I am, and it's part of what I enjoyed. So why not make it part of who you are? And that's why I set up AOM Fitness. And, you know, I love what I do, and it's something I do every day.
Good man. Well, listen, we've taken up enough of your time. It was great chatting to you. Fascinating. And best of luck with the business and the book over the next couple of days. I'm sure people are looking for a stocking filler, which doesn't hurt. But Aidan O'Mahony, great to have you on. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Joe.
Off the ball.
Find us on Twitter at Off the Ball.
News Talk 106 to 108.